And so, without further ado, it's my absolute thrill to introduce Danny Dawley and Paul Mason to our stage.
Thank you very much. We have a little chat before we begin. So the plan is we're going to talk to you about GDP first of all, then about what actually makes people happy, and then we should get on to business. Quite a lot of you are wafting. And I was just sort of thinking about this to do with business, whether if we could all waft simultaneously. I don't know whether this, but I'm not sure we can arrange it like that. I'm a geographer, not an economist, so I'm going to give you the very, very simple version of GDP, and then also going to get more complicated. We haven't always had GDP. It was a measure invented around the time of the Second World War. If you look for series of data on it, you'll find that people have reconstructed it for the past before then, but those are estimates made from other measures. It's a very, very weird measure of productivity. My favourite thing about GDP is it's the most unreliable of all of the Office of National Statistics official statistics. They keep on revising their estimates of what's happened for years. Sometimes 12 years in the past, they tell you they've got it wrong. It's not because of actual lack of funds, ONS is strapped for funds for most things, but their business section is the best funded section. It's just really, really hard to do and hard to measure. We have an obsession with saying that if in two quarters GDP falls, that's a recession. This is just a convention. You'll probably know it fell, I think, in the last quarter. Yeah. But whether it really did or not, we won't actually discover for years to come. And we have an obsession with it. Even Gordon Brown, who was probably our most radical Prime Minister of the last two or three decades, even Gordon Brown had a target wanting GDP to grow by something like 2% a year, with no acceptance that that cannot carry on forever, but also that that's an almost automatic target for increased inequality worldwide. When you measure GDP on a global scale, the vast bulk of it is in Europe, North America, and Japan. Wanting it to continue to grow at that level here really is a wish for greater inequality in the future. Economists differ very much about what they think sustainable growth rates might be. And I get to sit in and listen to them. I'm a geographer, not an economist. And some very progressive economists will talk about more sustainable growth, but they absolutely, definitely want growth. And then there are another set of economists who are more green, who want to study state economy. And it's interesting that there is no settled view on this. GDP can also be redefined. One thing that Gordon Brown tried to do is put things like healthcare within the official measures and so on. But as it is at the moment, if we were to go to war in the next year, all that spending on going to war would count greatly towards GDP, and it would look as if we were very productive. If we managed to avoid that, if we decided not to buy new aircraft carriers and so on, that wouldn't look so good. That's my very, very simple introduction to GDP for you. Hand over to Paul.
Well, yeah, I mean, and don't take me as an economist. I'm a political economist, a writer about political economy, and a very heterodox thinker about economics. So don't put this in your A-level essay, unless you're planning to go to SOAS. What do we know about the history of the world? We know that because of Angus Maddison's retrospective, which you talked about, really clever projection of world GDP back to the year dot, the technological change, progress, increases the gross domestic product of the world. That is the amount of commercial activity. That's one way of putting it. The amount of value add, as business wants to talk about. And the really interesting thing is that at moments of big technological change, usually you get a hike in the amount of GDP. Think of a graph which is really, really, really low, back in the time of Christ, and still really, really low, still at the back of the time of Thomas Aquinas, and still round about a little bit up, sort of round about the time of, you know, Henry VIII, yeah, brass cannon, etc. And then takes off at a 45 degree angle around about 200 years ago. That's GDP of the world. And after the Second World War, takes off at about a 70 degree angle. And you could quite easily imagine it, if you look at that graph, you think of it, I'm doing it to me, but if I do it to you, and analog PowerPoint, you start like this, like that. You could quite easily imagine it going exponential. But it's not. So what's going on? GDP per head is a different story. GDP per head stagnates throughout human history until the Industrial Revolution. And GDP per head, again, is massively, massively increased by technological change. So as a measure of technological change and its social impact in history, it's an interesting measure. That graph doesn't tell you whether the economy was, or the social structure was capitalist, or the Ottoman Empire, or ancient Rome. It doesn't tell you anything about that. But it tells you that what one human being was able to produce and then consume, their share of the social wealth has increased over human history. And in fact, that is, we are the only species, as far as we know, to which that has happened, because we're imagineers and we're collaborators and we're linguists, and almost no species have that combination of things. So all that's good for me, but as an economic thinker, my explanation of where we are in this story, it goes like this. The true history of technological progress and human take-up is only 200 years old. And if you're trying to measure it with GDP, you're going to have a problem. Because we'll come to happiness in a minute, but like this. Adam Smith, David Ricardo, who's a later economist, and Karl Marx didn't work with any notion similar to what we know as GDP. They worked with the idea like this, that the total value of all the products in society is about the same as the total value of all the work that's been done to produce them. And what it costs to produce a human being, that is to feed, clothe and educate a human being, translated into work, then produces wealth. And Adam Smith said that it was not through gold or silver or plunder that the wealth of nations was created, but from work. So that is a very radical theory. And it's no surprise to see the modern economists, started in the 1870s, completely trashed it. The idea that wealth, that the source of the wealth is the work of human beings, and that there's a rough similarity between what, say, an iPod costs and what the labour of the people who make it together cost plus the raw material, is turned out to be really far too radical for capitalism. And so you then get the rise of a form of economics which we call marginalism, which says the value of a thing is what it brings at the moment it's needed. So, it's condom versus taxi ride, at 3 a.m. in the morning. Which do I need most? Not me, age 59, but something younger. I need sleep. That's marginalism. And so for them, it's really interesting that the economic orthodoxy is to measure what GDP is measuring, is the money value of everything that's being produced and all the wages paid. But really their theory is that those values are random, because it's all to do with what was the value to you at the last moment when you needed it. If you nobody needs a taxi, the value of a taxi ride is zero. Now, Marxists and heterodox political economists like me work with this idea of the different use value and exchange value. The use value, the usefulness, the happiness creating content of the thing is here, and it is detached from its commercial value. And the two can differ. Now, this is why I think it is possible for us to see GDP stagnate in monetary terms, and yet human happiness rise. Because technological progress, I know you've done some work on technological progress, but in the last 25 years, technological change has been big, and the physical cost of doing most things is collapsing. The cost of making an aeroplane, the cost of educating a human being, the cost of a gigabit of bandwidth, is exponentially falling. Deloitte calls it exponential technology. So, you know, there are perfectly reasonable capitalists who believe that the usefulness could even take off exponentially, but people like me just don't believe that it's going to feed through into commercial value. Another word for this is the so-called zero marginal cost effect of the internet that makes the cost of things very, very low, close to zero. So in this conundrum, this to me explains why we are seeing a stagnation of capitalism. GDP is having trouble growing in the developed world. It will carry on having trouble growing in the developed world. However, there's quite a large reserve of happiness-creating content, that is, you know, being able to make things that you can still do while doing that. The problem is, if you've borrowed $257 trillion, is it now, as a world, against the future being wealthier than the past, that's where your problem is. Because it means all that debt is stacked up against a future that can't repay it. So that's my kind of general theory of the world as regards GDP, and why I'm not obsessed with GDP. Yeah.
It is just key to remember it is a very recent invention, and an invention that came out of wartime economies that thought you could simply measure these things, and if they got bigger, that would be better. The debt is really interesting. In one way of thinking about the system we've been living in for the last 200 years, the capitalist system, which began in Europe and spread out around the world as we went and invaded places to make it spread around the world, is that it worked because the markets were ever expanding. They were first of all expanding because of invasion and colonisation, and then they expanded even more because when you do invade and colonise places, the steady social systems that were in operation there, in some cases for millennia in terms of Australia, but certainly for centuries, all break down. And when steady social systems break down, people have more babies. So 200 years ago, the population of the world was at 1 billion. It had been rising ever so slowly. When capitalism began and spread, the population of the world began to explode. It went up and up and up and up, faster and faster. Now, that's great if you're Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has a very simple model. The executives at Coke are constantly trying to look for new things they could do, and they can never find anything quite as profitable as selling you sugary water made to a recipe from 18 whatever. And it works while there are more and more people, particularly young people. But that is coming to an end. We are almost at 2.1 children per woman on the planet. We're around about 2.4, and it's falling rapidly. This system that we live under at the moment requires more and more people for it to make sense. The debt is fine, as long as there are more and more people that it can be shared amongst in future. But if there are fewer people, it doesn't work anymore. And there's also signs that technological change is beginning to slow down. I'm not 59, I'm 51. So I was born in 1968. It's a great year for technology. The first 747 flew then. We're still flying in 747s today. We have bigger innovations like Concorde. They've gone. I had a mobile phone in my mid-20s, I think. As a child, I had a computer which had a Windows system because I was weird and nerdy. But, you know, that isn't new.
And it still doesn't work.
it's still on. I had the internet at university in the late 1980s. I work in university, and one thing universities do, they are private businesses now, by the way, in Britain. So we'll talk about business later. I feel qualified as I now work in one. One thing universities do is they constantly tell you stories about all the things they're helping to create and invent and so on, and how wonderful it is. But the rate of this and the new products appears, as far as I can tell, to be going down. So it's slowing. GDP, as conventionally measured, rose fastest in the 1950s, slightly slower in the 60s, slow again in the 70s, slow in the 80s, slow in the 90s, once you average it out. And of course, we, along with the 2008 Great Recession, that managed to make it even slower for the last decade. There's constant hope, oh, somehow we will get back up again, without a realisation that this thing we're measuring, although it isn't very useful for many things, is telling us something very interesting about ourselves. And the last thing I'll say, your graph. I was involved in a group called World Mapper, and we took Angus Madison's data. Angus Madison's an amazing man. He died a few years ago. He was a Geordie. He went off and became, well, he was high up in OECD, and ended up a professor at the University of Groningen. And single-handedly, he produced his best data set, not just of GDP, but also the one that's used for world population estimates. And I will not try and do the graph backwards, because my brain doesn't work like that. Paul described the overall exponential rise and then slowing down. If you look at it for different regions of the world, Europe goes up first, and then is caught up by North America, which is then later caught up by Japan in the 70s and 80s, and then China moves off the line with India and up into the middle. So you have an incredible geographical pattern of fanning out. And at the bottom is almost all of Africa. Africa GDP actually fell in the 80s and 1990s. And it fell partly because of the debt that we said they had to repay, and then the structural adjustment policies that we put in on most countries on that continent. And one of the remarkable things that we've learned recently is that one of the reasons why we are at 2.4 children per couple worldwide, not lower, is that fertility is still fairly high in Africa. It's 4 children per woman, the same as Queen Elizabeth, I always like to think. Why is it at 4 children per woman? Because in the 1980s, and particularly late 1990s, as a result of the structural adjustment that we put in because of our models of economics, women, young women, girls, couldn't go to secondary school in many countries in Africa. And if you don't go to secondary school, you're much more likely to have an extra child. So if any of you are worrying about world population, which is currently estimated to peak at about 10 or 11 billion, then we'll probably peak at 9 or 10, the reason why the majority of the growth to come, apart from us aging, is an extra billion people in Africa, turns out to be our economic policies imposed by us and the USA through the IMF and the World Bank on that continent. These are the kind of things that we have to take into account. It'll be interesting to see what happens in future. Economists do change what they do, but they kind of suddenly change as a herd. It's a very strange club, the club of economics. You know, if you don't behave, you don't adhere to the rules, you're not allowed in. That's why no university department in this country has yet gone properly heterodox. It's why the most interesting heterodox economist in Cambridge is really on his own, despite the fact that his books sell more than all the other academics in that department put together. He's still shunned as being not a true believer of the faith. But the faith is going to alter at some point because it was found to be so wanting.
Yeah, I think we want to wrap up on GDP. One thing I wanted to throw in is the currently popular idea of secular stagnation. This is an idea that Alvin Hansen in the 1930s proposed. That basically, there can be a point where the ability of the economy to grow and the ability of states to stimulate growth when the economy itself isn't doing that can both falter at the same time. Now this was written on the eve of World War II, and so it was disproved. But it's become more and more prevalent. Larry Summers, the ex-Treasury Chief of Clinton, is a very clear proponent of it. And more and more of your central banks, the most powerful agents in the world economy, are coming around to the idea that it is possible. And I think that they look at it in terms like this, you know, when there's not much growth, and when there's an oversaturation of savings, which is what there is, you know, $257 trillion of debt is an oversaturation of savings. Somebody has saved that money and not spent it, so it can be borrowed. So there's too much debt, so what happens when there's an oversupply of stuff? It's price wars. So in basic terms, that means you cannot charge high interest rates on money anymore. Now, the interest rate set by central banks is the core interest rate of capitalism. You know, you used to be able to be 2-3%. Now, central banks, can't really, and governments can't charge much interest. So too much debt, interest is low, you know this in your pension, you can't live on the yields from the government debt you're owning. And then what happens then? If there's a recession, the government has got too few things to do to stimulate growth, because it could borrow, and I'm a big believer in fiscal stimulus, in borrowing, and also cutting the tax burden, but in an equitable way, if you can, and borrow, spend, and let the debt accumulate. That's what we're doing. But it can't be done, And I think this is right. But another purely analogue, and I think, very interesting way of framing it is, what do central banks think the long-term sources of growth are going to be? There's a really interesting paper, 2015, by two Bank of England economists called Rachel and Smith, okay? And they've shown, again, in analogue graph terms, and like this, that in the last 30 years, growth has been driven by a mixture of catch-up growth, so Turkey becomes more like Italy, Kenya becomes more like Turkey, more roads, more better education, and extensive, that is, adding more workers to the population of the world, so more women, more elderly people, more women into work. This is expanded growth. According to this Bank of England estimate, and it is only an estimate, there is no growth attributable to technological change whatsoever in the last 30 years. But then it gets worse, because catch-up growth peters out, and the other kinds of growth, sort of growth stimulated by borrowing, clearly that's not going to be much of that, and then the growth attributable to more population, that's going to peter out. And so, on their own estimates, the rates of growth of the world are going to be half in the next 30 years, what they've been in the last 30 years. And what it means for our world, in case you haven't noticed, is that, game theory was really popular in the neoliberal era, because the ultimate proposition of neoliberalism is win-win. I close down your factory in Illinois and I move it to China, you get to do a better job with less onerous, the Chinese economy grows. Now, the win-win can't happen in a zero or negative sum world. And what you're starting to get is elites like Trump, like Bolsonaro, saying, screw win-win. Now, there's only going to be so much growth in the world, only going to be so much wealth. How does our country and our elite get it? So that is how I think this petering out of the normal sources, the recent sources of GDP growth, has translated into politics. And sooner or later, you can see in the Trump-China trade war now, overlapped with all kinds of politics and argy-bargy, that will be the pattern of the next 30 years, unless we decide to stop it.
Yeah. And that question about whether we're going to decide to stop it. So let's move on to happiness. We'll get a good debate. I think the last one, just make you feel better on happiness. One argument about why we are getting this slowdown in growth is we've done all the easy inventions with coal power and electricity. This is the big thing of our time. We have more power. A good example is air conditioning. You can invent air conditioning once, you may wish for air conditioning now. There isn't a second form of air conditioning that makes people even more productive. Basically, once you've got the temperature to 22 degrees Celsius, that's it, and you can go through. Happiness. Who can remember David Cameron? In 2011, at all, yes, that's it. 2010, he announced he was going to start to report a happiness measure. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you ever remember him telling you about it? No? Well, the good old Office of National Statistics were charged with producing this measure, and they loyally went and did it, and they produce it to this day. It's just they never tell you what, well, they do, but nobody reports it. They partly don't report it. I've got a friend from ONS, I think, here, so I'll be careful. Because they have to be politically neutral, they put together an index of 30-odd different measures which blur everything that doesn't tell you very much. However, in the middle of the index, there are four key measures, which are four measures about health. How you're feeling, how's your health. When you get to our age, you begin to realise that actually health is the most important thing, being happy. If you're young, just enjoy it. The older you get, and as you get older, you begin to worry about the health of other people in your family as well. Now, this measure of happiness, which was produced because of Cameron in 2010, included questions from the British Household Panel survey about, are you satisfied with your health, is your health good, and so on, reported in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014. And each year, that component of the happiness index fell, and then fell absolutely dramatically. And I showed this to a bunch of epidemiologists, and they looked at it and they said, oh, somebody's made a mistake. That never happens. That can't be true. What was really interesting and quite sad is after 2014, in fact slightly before for elderly women, people started dying faster. So we actually asked them how they were from 2010 onwards, and we ignored their answers. It's a bit like what's written on Spike Milligan's grave. You know, I told you I was ill. Measuring the happiness of the population really matters. But you can't necessarily measure it by a question of on a scale from 1 to 10 how happy you are. That does produce interesting results for looking at changes over time. But in short, Americans tend to say 8 because they've been taught to. Right? It's automatically, you know, how are you? I'm great. People in countries which are much more stable head towards 5. Because, of course, a rational answer on a scale from 1 to 10 about how happy are you is, I'm averagely happy, it's a 5. But we can look at the up and downs in this. Measuring people's health, measuring life expectancy, checking for happy babies. Oh, babies make people happy, by the way. Me and my friend Dimitris Ballas. Dimitris is a Greek economist. If you're taught economics in Greece, you're taught half of what we were taught today, level and so on. The other half is actually heterodox Marxist economics. They have a very different model of what they're taught. When we were looking at what it is that determines how happy you are, we looked at the answers by about 30,000 people to about 9,000 possible questions, and determined there are only 32 things that matter in life in terms of happiness. The most important are health, good health, and so on, that makes you unhappy. What makes people most happy is starting new relationships and having a baby, but not looking after children. Having a baby. On average, and the least significant thing I've ended on are the 32 things. I can go on and on about this because I find it fascinating. Parents are made much more happy by their children's education than children themselves. Grandparents in particular are very, very proud of their parents. Of the 32 things that can ever happen to you, the least important that still registers is passing your driving test. So, congratulations. Yeah.
So, I mean, I have very little to add about this, but because we, you know, the economic people, we don't, apart from the kind of freakonomics, you know, it's interesting, why are freakonomics and all that stuff, you know, studying the really interesting interaction between the weather and the price of cocaine in Baltimore, you know, why did that come about? Because they thought all problems were solved. Why did economists start doing behavioural and microeconomics? Because they thought the big stuff had all been solved, they stabilised the world. Now they've been disabused of that. And a lot of what I'm involved in is to try and basically sort of predict the scale and shape and direction of the crisis we're going to live through. And in that regard, I suppose what I want to say about happiness is this. It's manifestly true that in developed world societies we're moving from productive to human services type of jobs, type of activity. And that's because making things has become very easy to automate because of information technology. That is, the factory of the mid-60s, the factory in which all those Italian anarchist workers used to do conga lines and seize the factory, why did they have so much power? Because throughout capitalism, until 25 years ago, there was a great saying, the manager's brain is under the workman's cap. That is, without the workers' folk knowledge, nothing worked. Work to rule was a way of stopping a factory. because you had, workers had a wage around everything. And this was because even in a highly electrified factory like, say, Fiat in the 1970s, where the machines were electrified, they were semi-robotic, what there never was a feedback. So you could basically, you could have the most accurate die stamp, and they didn't have accurate die stamps, but the only reason we can have 2-micron thick cutting machines and make intricate shapes is because we have digital feedback, because a laser can tell you where you are. And until lasers and data, that even advanced capitalism needed workers. But now it doesn't, and most production barely needs workers. If it has it's because workers are so cheap, because the bosses won the class struggle in the 1970s and 80s. So that's why we used to have 4,000 car wash machines and very few hand car washes. Now we have 1,000 car wash machines installed in British forecourts and 20,000 hand car washes, largely staffed by extremely oppressed and in some cases trafficked people. They are cheaper than the machine, but in general, under prime conditions of the rule of law and competition, automation is working. Like you say, many of the things that need to be automated have been automated. I visited an amazing virtual manufacturing place in Salford, where the guys told me that the old guys, they worked on the tail fin of the British Tornado fighter bomber in the start of their careers, and they did 12 stress tests on it with slide rules and electronic calculators. You remember the electronic calculators? The same guy with his kind of beard and his gold watch is about to leave. He said, when we worked on its successor, the Eurofighter, we did 186 million tests on it at the same time on 3 supercomputers, one in Canada, one in China, one here. Now, that means when those planes fly, they're perfect. There's no defects. There's no engineering process. However, so we're going to move to put people-to-people services. That's great. There's plenty of economic value in people-to-people services. But, the problem is, if at the same time you want to systematically depress the price of labour by defeating the working class and forcing everybody to live on bullshit and peanuts, it's a spiral. Because what we're going to end up with, and what we have ended up with, is economies where the girl who works in Zara buys her lunch at Subway, and the man behind the counter at Subway buys his shirt in Zara, and their wages are going down. You know, and there is no high value work. Where is the high value service to service work?
When I was about 12, my dad took me to the car factory we lived nearby. I think to try to get me to work hard at school, because it was really, really noisy.
You don't want
to wear a beer. It was hot, and you could smell the lead paint and everything. That car factory, which used to employ 40,000 and the industries around it, 40,000 almost all men, mostly married with children, filled up half the homes in the city I grew up in. And those jobs were, in real terms, paid twice what most people's jobs are paid today. They were good jobs, but you lived a shorter life because of what you lived through. Today, the car factory is still there. Today, it produces more cars than ever. It produces them with robots, the most amazing, almost silent robots. There are 3,000 people employed. 1,500 of them are looking after the robots. It's a really nice job because the robots tend to work. And the other 1,500 are largely men from Eastern Europe who work on the seventh line, the manual line, in case the robots go on strike or something. I don't know why they're there. This factory, it's the BMW Mini factory in Oxford. This factory produces a Mini every 1 minute and 2 seconds. You, well not all of you, probably about 5% of these people in this room, could, on your phone now, order your Mini. And you can decide what colour you want, everything and so on. And they will put it together, the robots on the line, to your exacting standard. But it will cost you a lot of money. Whereas the cost of the old Mini was a people's car, it was relatively cheap. The profit, I think, that BMW make is something like £20,000 per Mini every 1 minute, 2 seconds. Now, the second big producer in the city of Oxford are the two universities. And we also have a production line. We call it postgraduate students. And we get most of them in from abroad. They can pay £20,000, 25, if you want to do finance, £31,000 for a master's in finance. We produce one of those every hour at the University of Oxford and Brookes University. So we are 60 times less productive as an export earner than the Mini Car Factory. And why am I telling you this? Because the Mini Car Factory may not be there this time next year. You can move the robots. They don't build any robot too big to fit in the back of a lorry. So you can shift the entire factory out in just over a week. Great, we might say. All that space. We can build another university campus. Which would be great if we can. I wish we would do that kind of thing. But the way we do our economics at the moment, it isn't actually going to make enough money to get by. Despite all the puff of us telling you what a wonderful University Oxford is, there aren't enough rich children in the world to come and do master's degrees at £20,000 pop. And also, it shouldn't cost £20,000 to do a master's degree. This is a silly thing that we've inflated. They didn't exist when I was the age at which you could do a master's. They've been created in a market to make money in the short term so that you can say on your CV that you're different and special to other people. And that kind of Ponzi scheme doesn't work forever.
I suppose I want to throw in what the orthodox economists would say to me and Danny is that capitalism always creates new needs, and even if the price of, like, you know, say a ballpoint pen falls or a light bulb, then there'll be new needs that people need, and then they need higher skills to make them because they're complex things, so they cost more. So the new BMW might be a drone or something. But the problem about this is first of all that there's a superb French Marxist writer called André Gortz who points this out really well. He said, look, imagine, however, that you're trying to do this in a highly service-orientated, a people-to-people-orientated economy. Gortz says, in addition to the problem that the class struggle then works against progress, so that the more the bosses win, the poorer society becomes. Because the hairdresser and the nail bar person, you know, and the guy in the hand car wash are all living on a pittance. There's another problem, says Gortz, and he labelled it the limits of economic reason. And what it's translated into ordinary speak, it's this. For capitalism to go on innovating new needs at a time when those needs are mainly human to human, so machines, are, you know, we could leave up to the robot, then what you have to do is invade more and more of the non-market space of human life for the market. Now, in other words, Gortz, who died, I think, in the 90s, he said, well, you know, you're going to end up like geisha work. There's going to be forms of sex work that are not straightforward, you know, old prostitution, but, you know, friendship work, says Gortz. Now, actually, you know, I don't know if you know what webcams are, but there are tens of thousands of performers in the sex industry in Britain performing on webcams in their back rooms. They need nothing other than a webcam. It's come true. But after a while, even that's not enough. And what Gortz said is, like, the more the market then begins to crowd into human life, you, at some point, people resist. Fine, the commercialization of sex. But what are we going to have? You know, you come up to me after this and we say hi. Do I charge you by the minute, like some lawyer from a commercial lawyer in Canary Wharf? No, because at some point we resist the commercialization of human to human personal life, and that is one of the ultimate limits for me of capitalism.
We did. I mean, other European universities, you go for free. You can do master's courses for almost nothing. If you want to do a PhD, you're not actually charged a fee to do one. It seems odd to us because we become so commercialised. We've only got another couple of minutes before we do questions, so please take your questions. We promised to talk to you about business. This human to human thing is really big. I've been looking at the hair of the men in this tent, because there's some very beautiful haircuts around. The reason I was looking at your hair is that when I was young, men tended not to go and get their hair cut. Or if they did, they went to a barber, it was very cheap, and got it cut very quickly. Hairdressers needed to expand, and so they moved into cutting men's hair. But there's a limit to how much you can do this. The hair won't grow any faster. You know, there's only so much you can do to it. Men in particular used to cut their hair at home, or a woman would cut it for them because it saved money. There's a limit to grooming each other. We are the form of ape. Moving in effect is the form of the future. 80% of our economy plus is services. In one way or another, this is making each other happy. The tragedy of webcams and prostitution, which is higher in this country than in almost any other country in Europe. They actually added it to GDP, didn't they, recently? Yeah. And the sales of cocaine, where we also come out on top. It obviously doesn't work. Businesses. There will always be business, in my point of view. I remember being shocked at the time of the banking crisis in 2008, that one of the constituencies that was most angry about how the government were dealing with this and bailing out the banks were small business people, who felt that they were being put in the same boat or category as bankers. Now, sadly, that divide within business wasn't exploited at the time. I wish it had been. You get business everywhere. You have business in China. There are three sectors in China. There's the sector directed directly by the Communist Party, there is foreign direct investment, and there are small businesses. There will always be businesses. The thing we have to worry about are the monopoly businesses, the giant businesses, things like Amazon, which have done us a great favour of producing a more efficient way of delivering goods, which is one van going down your street rather than all of you going shopping. The carbon was actually less. But now they've created the utility in the monopoly, it's time we took it over, possibly at a European level, would make more sense. The businesses we tend to complain about are these large monopoly businesses. Small businesses are a very, very, very different kettle of fish. 99% of them die within 10 years. And we know that from VAT registrations. And of course they have to. Because if they didn't die within 10 years, the world would be absolutely full of businesses. People don't start a business knowing that. I'm sorry if I've upset anybody with that particular statistic. But of course it has to be true. There are kind of triumphs of optimism over reality. The chances of your idea actually working and your shop making a profit and you getting a second shop is staggeringly low, and it has to be. Just numerically, it's not possible for it to be greater than that. Any more business before
we... Well, look, the question was, do we need a big reset? And I think yes, but we need a big reset. But the role of business in that can be... I'll be really acutely political here. So, for the last 30 years, government stepped back and said the market has to decide everything. You know, the government can't do anything that's bad for the markets. If the market was like this King Kong sitting in a corner, basically as a person, it's a disembodied thing. But the market is just us, what we do, and it can be irrational. Now, I think that climate change is going to demand urgent, target-focused action from us as a civil society. And you just can't... It won't work. If we had 50 years, you could see maybe the market delivering a benign outcome. I can't see anything other than ruthless centralised action delivering a benign outcome. There's a power station burning coal. It's burning coal because it's profitable to do so. Don't try and drive the car with a kind of bendy stick. Do you know what I mean? Don't try and sort of influence that business's behaviour by doing something here to tax legislation, here to carbon emission. You go in and say this business is unacceptable to us as a civil society. You're closing. While you're clapping, the problem is, even in its romantic form, FDR's, FDR's, what's it called, the New Deal, or the expansion of the American state in World War II, it's still brutal. But in its unromantic form, like, you know, Stalinism, like picking up factories and moving them from Kiev to the Urals, and destroying the lives of everybody who worked in them, and forcing people to live in ditches, that's not so romantic. But I think that the state is going to have to direct business for climate change alone. But the second reason is, because you follow my work on post-capitalism, because I don't believe there is enough value to justify the debt that most societies are carrying, at some point there'll be a great reckoning of who actually is holding the worthless debt. There'll be a huge cataclysm in your lifetime, young people. And at this point, you know, what stopped, you know, what we saw in 2008 was only an echo of what will happen in a real credit crunch. Because what happened in 2008 is Woolworths closed. What happens in an epic proper crisis is Tesco closes. Yeah? And at that point, you can't have the ministers going, we're looking for a buyer. You know, or it's like with Scunthorpe at the moment, we're looking for a buyer, it just happens to be, you know, the pension fund of a military dictatorship. You can't. There's going to have to be politicians who understand that. And then what? Final sentence. Then, of course, what you crowd businesses out of easy state handouts of profits, like, you know, to Capita and all this, all the ones that have gone bust, the service companies. But you crowd businesses into innovation. So you see, that virtual manufacturing of in Salford that employs 6,000 well-paid people in, you know, beautiful white shirts and driving MGs and Lamborghinis. Good. I don't want to nationalise that. I want more. I want two of them. You know, and how we do that is incentivise that and disincentivise capital to invest in the easy money of Amazon, Google, and Apple. So yeah, government's going to have to just do something big.
Okay, last one for me on that. As sponsored advertiser, not my, the case for the Green New Deal, you can't get it yet, you can be ordered by Anne Pettiford. Because this is the big thing coming, it's already starting in the States, there's a Green New Deal movement in this country before, but it's getting bigger. I sometimes think it's absolutely divine that the relationship between carbon dioxide pollution and temperature rise is so pitifully simple. It's linear, and it didn't have to be, but it really is linear. So almost everybody in the world can get their head around what is going to happen. It is that simple. And you may think, you know, Paul's being a bit shocking about this, but this has happened in Europe very recently. Remember, you write about the violet dog in Athens. At the time you were writing about that violet dog, I was with my friend Beatrice Ballas, I told you about earlier. He just managed to get a job back in Greece, an academic job, which was really, really hard to do. There was a waiting list because they weren't hiring anybody because Greece, the economy fell apart. And I remember walking with him to the cash point machine when he tried again to see whether he'd be allowed to take his €800 monthly wage as an associate professor out, and he couldn't. It was 3 months before he was allowed to take his wage out. It was there in the account, but he couldn't actually get it out. And it's hard to describe this. We used to take a field trip of students every year from Sheffield to Athens. 2004, 2005, 2006, it was really a party. Our main problem was students getting too drunk, putting them in a recovery position. Occasionally students get themselves arrested and having to get them out of jail. But when the crash hit, and we took our students again to the same hotel, they didn't get drunk anymore because they were shocked. They were shocked to see old people walking around with cups for coins. And what everybody had in their pocket were pennies. And what you each gave was a penny when a pensioner walked past with a cup. And that was the situation. It was that bad. People had abandoned their dogs, so there were dogs all over the place because they couldn't afford to feed the dogs anymore. And our students from the University of Sheffield learned more in 1 week in Athens, year after year after year of the crisis, than they learned in 3 years of somebody like me talking at them, because it's less effective. This is entirely possible. This is where we are heading to at the moment. If we are sensible enough, we will work out a way that it is not as painful as it looks like it could be. We currently have the most ridiculous cabinet in charge of our country that we have possibly ever had, which may be beneficial because they make it really, really clear what the choice is. They want to keep this casino going. They think this casino will self-right itself. They believe none of this. They think that what we're saying is dangerous, ill-informed, stupid, because the 3 years that they spent in university in the 1980s supposedly taught them everything that they ever need to know, which is when they formed their political beliefs. We do have to worry about it. This country in particular is at more risk than any other country in Europe because of the game we're playing right now with tightrope politics about where we are. It's dangerous, and it's part of become a bigger global problem. The current system cannot carry on, and debt cannot carry on rising. We can't keep on telling young people that they're going to have to pay back more and more for something that we got for free. The question is when and how it will end, and we do not know the answer to that. We just know that the temperature rises linearly with the pollution that we put into the atmosphere. Thank you very much.
Look, we'll take them two at a time, keep them gender balanced, and we'll brief. So, shout it out.
Shout out and I'll repeat it.
Okay, I'm a councillor on Tyneside, and the government are pushing a free ports agenda towards us at the moment. So I've got a political economist and a geographer. Sweeney, do you know anything about free ports?
Oh, I see. Yeah. Free ports, and then let's take a look over there. We'll come back on that. They said everything's going to be audited that we do against well-being. I think it's a really powerful weapon because, you know, food needs going to make hospital food better. Footnote, for a range of budgets, there'll be a free hospital food that'll be better than it is now and free, but there'll be others that you'll pay for. And who will the person serving that new, improved hospital food work for? And I want to be able to go, you know, as my elderly relative sitting comatose in an overstressed ward with no staff, I don't want one of the staff to be Prulis effing, you know, waiter. I want them to be a nurse or medical assistant employed by the NHS and available to everybody in the ward. So, well-being is a fantastic audit measure, and it's the reason that these elite people will not accept it.
Very, very quickly, I don't think the free ports will work because the EU27 is not going to allow us to create little tax havens to circumvent them. And a port only works if you've got somewhere to actually go to from the port that isn't a very long way away. Our current government policy is to maximise the carbon use of trade by not trading with the places nearest to it. And it is unbelievably stupid. New Zealand's interesting. They've reacted partly to the flight of the incredibly rich who bought ranches and other property on New Zealand. And that's telling because the incredibly rich themselves think that things may come to an end, which is why they're building their bunkers and escape routes on the other side of the world. And you should worry if they're starting to do that, but New Zealanders are beginning to tell them that they're not going to allow them. And in particular in Auckland, where the house prices are now astronomical, they're bringing in controls to stop that happening. And we're going to see more and more of this.
Do you not think the happiness index is going to start going like that as we enter the golden age of Britain? The purpose of the recording will need a description. Which direction we show it? Going up. Happiness going up. Okay. Happiness going up because of Brexit. Anybody else got a question?
Heterodoxy.
The last 3 minutes redefine heterodoxy. Go.
I'm the happiness curve. Personally, the most important thing to you about your happiness is actually your age. We tend to be quite happy as children, on average. It tends to go down. You have the kids, you're very happy. You look after the kids, you're less happy. It minimises, and this is around the world, around about age 50. So I'm on the up, you're higher up. And then it carries on actually rising and rising. People are really grateful to be 90 years old, irrespective of what their health is and so on. In terms of moving it over time, it's...
I know.
It's amazingly stubborn. To give you an optimistic thing, and in general, apart from the UK and the USA, things are getting better in most of the richest countries in the world, and also in a large number, the majority of the poorest. I mean, the one statistic that most gets me is about 5 years ago, infant mortality worldwide was 42 per thousand, and in 1 year it dropped to 40. That was the fastest fall ever. And it's carried on falling, hasn't fallen slightly slower, because you can never get below one per thousand. There are today fewer grieving parents this year than there were when I was born, despite the fact there were far, far, far more babies. And this is the kind of thing that really makes people happy. A century ago, 1 in 10 of the children of the servant-keeping classes of England saw their children die before the age of five. 1 in 10 of the children died before five. We should really count our blessings, but that huge improvement in our lives has gone through. What I find fascinating about all of this is we are designed to have a worry for children, which was completely rational. That particular physical worry should have gone. Your children will almost certainly now survive you. You need to transfer that worry, which is very personal, into a much wider worry. And you could do heterodox.
Orthodox and heterodox are just two words we actually borrow from religion to talk about economics. Basically, the economic orthodoxy, you know, it was the post-war era. John Maynard Keynes. And John Maynard Keynes' doctrines were applied to most developed countries. They worked. And people assumed that they would work forever. And then in the 70s, they blew up because they were reliant on a steady state of the class struggle. And workers actually managed to capture quite a lot of the product of society through striking. And then you had the oil shock. And so suddenly, Keynesian orthodoxy collapses, and then you get the new orthodoxy, neoliberalism, which is just saying, let the market rip, and let people compete, and let people stab each other in the back, and we'll win-win out of that. That is the orthodoxy talk, so PPE at Oxford, don't go on it. If you have to go anywhere near Oxford, do politics and history, don't do PPE, because what they teach you is bullshit. If they're teaching you the stuff that's in the minds of all these guys that crush the world. Now, and the reason why, heterodox simply means people who don't agree with it. But I've observed this about this class of Brahmins, you know, the economists. One problem they have is they cannot conceive of capitalism as a time-limited system. They cannot conceive of it like a butterfly or a car or a planet as an organism with a beginning, middle and an end. Everything else has a life cycle, but capitalism doesn't. In their minds, there was just things that went wrong before we perfected it. And it's a very, very dangerous way of looking at things. Leave aside their worship of efficient markets and market rationality. Their ahistoric understanding of what capitalism is the biggest problem of them. And therefore, practically, what do they produce? It's like producing doctors who don't understand illness. Because you study the functioning human being, and then you go, shit, one's gone missing a leg. What do I do about that? Or he's just keeled over. It would be crazy to do that. But we train economists to study abstract models of capitalism when it works, and to regard it not working literally as a dysfunction. Like, if you don't regard illness as a dysfunction of a human being, it's a function of a bacteria that's gone into the human being. But they look at these things, why is this happening? How can this be happening? My textbook says it doesn't happen. That would be frightening enough if they were doctors. It's even more frightening that they are the cut-off Brahmin class. You can't even access. They have their separate language. They go to Davos and Jackson Hole right now and G7 in Biarritz, and they hobnob with each other, reinforcing each other's belief that you can't tax rich people. That's one of their beliefs, the Laffer. But they are addicted. Their ignorance was worse than dangerous, because it taught people in power that there was no risk. So they took risks, they crashed the world, and whatever you're seeing now is the product of crashing the world in 2008.
Everything happens for me. politics on this occasion in time. Paul is having to run for a train, so send him out with a big cheer as we come back. Shortchanged by the Swift exit, he is very active on social media, so look him up on Twitter, follow him, continue to expand or fry your brain, however you took the session. Paul, Danny, I understand you're around for a bit more of a festival. Your book is on sale in the shop, so a round of applause and a thank you to Danny for your help.